This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Well, public debate about gun violence has been ongoing in the month or so since the mass shooting in Connecticut. And today that conversation went inside with hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's safe to predict, however, that with all the conversation about background checks and assault weapons, something that's likely not to get a lot of coverage is the relationship between firearms and suicide. And that's despite the alarming data. Of all the gun deaths in 2010, 3 out of 5 people who died from gunshot wounds took their own lives. And you might be surprised to know that this has been the case for almost a century. Here with me in Studio 3 to talk about how we should be thinking about suicide and about responsible gun ownership are Kathy Barber and Dr. Matt Miller. They're both at the Harvard School of Public Health's Injury Control Research Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So I have to reorient everybody, including myself, about this conversation so that we can, you know, get with the right perspective. Because when we typically think about guns and death, we think about guns and murder, not guns and suicide. Kathy Barber, why is that?
Well, it's what captures our attention in newspapers and on TV, and yet the greater numbers are suicides. There are about 19,000 gun suicides a year compared with about 11,000 gun homicides a year.
So why is it, do you think, that with those numbers as they are, upside down, one would say, that still our concentration has been on the relationship between guns and murder? Is it because suicide is really mental health and we just think about that in a whole different way?
I think because we fear what we can't control, and we assume that we control our own destiny, and fear homicide is something that we can't control. And yet, when we're in the grips of a mental health crisis or a life crisis, like a devastating relationship breakup, sometimes we do lose control. And in a number of situations, that's a temporary hardship to be weathered. And it's the access to highly lethal methods of suicide that sometimes can mean the difference between life and death in terms of when a person becomes temporarily suicidal and attempts suicide.
We're going to go deeper on that in just a minute, but I want to turn over to Matt and get you to share with us some of the, you know, I think startling statistics for folks to think about, because I mean, I really hadn't thought about it in this way. I somehow, you think about someone committing suicide by gun and it brings to mind an individual, but I don't think in aggregate numbers. So what numbers do you think that people need to hear to make them understand why this is a public health crisis? Because when we talk public health, we're talking about a larger community issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I would start out with the overall statistic that over 38,000 people die by suicide every year. In 2010, the last year for which we have national data, there are over 30,000 Americans who took their own lives. More than half used guns. That places suicide as the 10th leading cause of death in the United States for all ages and the second leading cause of death for people under 40 years of age. When you live in a country where 1 in 3 homes on average contain guns, where more than 300 million guns are in civilian hands, and where more than half of all suicides are firearm suicides, you can't have a conversation about suicide without talking about firearms.
And yet, you know, well, you know how the conversation is fraught in this country when you start talking about something that might suggest underlying, because you're public health people, that maybe there should be fewer guns, that folks should not be able to own guns. Let's put that on the table. That is not what you are saying, either of you.
No, I mean, to this conversation, I want to really warmly welcome both gun owners and non-gun owners, because both really have a stake in solving this problem. And wherever you might be on the issue of specific legislative proposals with respect to homicide, with respect to saving people's lives from suicide, it's largely family policies and individual policies that I think are going to make the difference in terms of really saving lives.
When you say family policies, what do you mean?
I know. It sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah.
If part of realistic and responsible gun ownership, I think, is being alert to signs of suicide or crisis in a family member or a loved one, and if they're at risk of harming themselves or others, taking steps to ensure that they don't have access to a firearm. And that's like a family thing or a neighbor-to-neighbor thing, a friends don't let friends drive drunk kind of thing where you notice, my spouse is going through a horrible time right now. I'm really afraid about what's happening. Now would be a good time to ask my neighbors. I mean, depending on the states and the laws in your states, now would be a good time to ask my friend to hold on to our guns temporarily until he weathers this storm.
Matt Miller, you want to get in on this? Would you add to that?
I would second what Kathy said, as I almost always do whenever she speaks. This is not a legislative issue. I mean, what really will make a big difference in the number of people who are dying by suicide is a shift in the social norms and the way the conversation that takes place around suicide and around responsible firearm ownership. As Kathy said, if it gets to a point where it's as easy for me to say to you, you're having trouble, your kid, it looks like he's been depressed, your husband's drinking a lot, maybe it's a good time to get the guns out of your home until the crisis passes. Until it becomes as easy for me to say that to you as it is for me to say to you, you know what, you've had too much to drink, I'm going to drive us home. Then we still have a lot of progress to make on the social norms front, which is where the population as a whole will be affected.
That's my guest, Matt Miller. Dr. Matt Miller, he's Associate Director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. I'm also here with Kathy Barber, who directs the Means Matter campaign at the Harvard School of Public Health's Injury Control Research Center. So now, you've just said it should be as easy as saying you've had too much to drink. Let's think about it. People are listening to this thinking, look, you know, what are the chances that somebody, just because you have a gun in the house, can somebody around who's depressed is going to go for a gun? I mean, that seems like a giant leap to most of us. I'm depressed, therefore a gun is accessible, therefore that's a danger point for me. Wouldn't it be more like, I'm depressed, I might take to my bed? You need to explain to me and to others here, all of us who are listening, why access to that gun really is more dangerous than if you're depressed or, I can't even say looking suicidal because I don't know what that means. So, right. Kathy Barber.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that you don't always know when a person is feeling suicidal, and an easy way is to ask. I mean, that can make a big difference because people are often really ambivalent. If they're struggling with thoughts of suicide, they're often ambivalent, and you want to try and talk to the part of the person that's trying to stay alive. And you also, you know, you have to use some kind of common sense. If a person is mildly depressed and you're not picking up any danger signals, no, it's not a conversation you necessarily have to have. But it's when there's a combination of factors going on, when you notice something's up with them and they're going through difficult life circumstances, like they're struggling with an addiction problem and they're in trouble with the law or they're going through a breakup. Often it's that confluence of kind of horrible things. And you know, people aren't perfect at reading one another. We're going to miss signs. We're going to overread signs. But we're going to try and do our best to respond to, especially when it's just clear. You know, a lot of times there's, you know, in public health, when we don't have a vaccine, you know, that's going to solve the problem, you go for the low-hanging fruit. And when you see a clear crisis, and you can think, well, one way to make this safer is if there aren't guns here. And obviously you want to also try and get mental health. Health help for the person.
So let's drill down a little bit, Kathy Barber, because, you know, this is what you do, you know, pay attention to the signs of suicide and make it clear to people that what we're talking about is folks responding in an acute manner, what you would call an acute manner. That's in the moment. Something has triggered and you feel like you're, you know, maybe you've been depressed for 5 days, but then something in that moment triggers you. And that's when you're at highest risk if there is a gun in the house.
That's the thing that's so counterintuitive for people. And it makes sense that they would think, why would temporarily getting rid of the guns make a difference? Because, you know, you can always find a way to take your life. And what what people don't realize, you know, they kind of picture that when a person becomes suicidal that they just stay suicidal and get worse and worse and worse, and don't realize that often the suicidal crisis, that acute period where you're really willing to actually pull the trigger or drink the poison or whatever, that period is often very short, and it's the work of mental health and public health people to try and help you get through that period alive. And the more lethal the method available to you during that period can really be the, you know, can really determine whether you live or die in that period.
And in fact, picking up on that, Matt Miller, you're a numbers guy. What's the possibility that if you're feeling suicidal and you have access to a gun that you are going to die?
So a couple of points that I want to follow up on. One is that it's really difficult, if not impossible, to predict which of a number of people who have major depressive disorder or alcohol or drug problems is going to go on to die by suicide. And because it's really impossible to know on the individual level, what we as public health practitioners talk about is what you can do to reduce the risk that somebody there will make a suicide attempt and die. And what you can do is you can have a general recommendation that when people are at risk for suicide, even though you may not be able to detect it in an individual, the best thing you can do to reduce the risk immediately and substantially is to remove the gun from the home, period, you know, full stop. The second best thing you can do is to store it in a way that prevents access by unauthorized users. I'm worried about my kid. He's been having bad grades for the first time ever. He doesn't seem depressed, but I'm concerned about it. If I don't remove the gun from the home, which is the best thing I could do, if I store it in a way that makes it impossible for him to get it, the key's in my pocket, not under the bed. You know, I don't rely on him not picking up the combination. That's the second best thing. Now, among adolescents, for example, the risk of suicide is 2 to 10 times higher if they live in a home with a gun compared to living in a home without a gun, depending on sort of how it's stored as well. If you live in a state like Massachusetts, where gun ownership is on the very low side for the United States as a whole, but on the very high side for high-income countries, of course, your chances of dying by suicide are, you know, 2 to 3 times less than if you live in a state where the gun ownership rates are a lot higher. And that's not because we are more suicidal. It's not because we're more depressed. It's not because we have higher rates of mental illness or substance abuse. It's because when in an acute crisis, someone acts impulsively and can reach for a gun, they're just so much more likely to die than when they reach for almost any other commonly used method.
How much more likely are they to die?
50-fold. So, I mean, it's enormous. And if you can pose it as a question. So people need to think about this. So you look across the United States and you compare states with high guns to low guns. And what you see are suicide rates due to guns in the high gun states that are 5-6 times higher. Suicide rates due to all other methods combined are not all that different. The net effect is suicide rates are 2 or 3 times higher in the high gun compared to the low gun states. The question is why? People in high gun states are not more careless, they're not more hostile, they're not more suicidal, they're not more depressed. And what drives the increase in the risk is suicide, risk of firearm suicide. And that's very tightly correlated with the presence of a gun in the home. Those sort of observations that get people to start to sort of wrestle with the facts, I think is a really good way to start a conversation to get them thinking about what is the best thing that they can do in their own enlightened self-interest to protect themselves and their families.
I'm talking with Matt Miller and Kathy Barber. They're at the Harvard School of Public Health's Injury Control Research Center. And we're talking about firearms and suicide, an angle on the whole perspective of gun violence that's not often considered. And yet there are larger numbers of people killing themselves with firearms and committing suicide. And both Kathy Barber and Dr. Miller are suggesting that there's a way that they can reduce the numbers quite simply, and that is something called means restriction, Kathy, which is a very highfalutin term for saying controlling access to the guns.
Yeah. And I think it's really important that gun owners be part of this conversation and part of this effort, because I think it's important if to the extent that non-gun owners are talking about this, that we kind of check any, like it's important that this not be an anti-gun effort, mm-hmm. and not be informed by any anti-gun bias, because that's not going to help at all. And it's, I think, most effective when gun owners and leaders, like kind of opinion leaders in the gun owning community, take on this message and bring it as a caring message to gun owning families. And a really good example of that was a collaboration up in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Firearm Safety Coalition, where suicide prevention, public health, firearm dealers, and gun rights activists all got together on a coalition to work on what the role of gun shops could be in suicide prevention.
And we should say this has been going on since 2009, but
yeah,
continue.
And it was a great group of people who had so much common ground and so much goodwill and creativity and caring about this issue. I thought it was a remarkable bringing together of people of all stripes.
And what was the result of that?
The result was a campaign that went out to all of the gun shops in New Hampshire that had two aims. One was to help gun shop owners kind of pick up on signs of suicide in customers who might be seeking guns for suicide. We learned that 8% of the firearm suicides in New Hampshire were recent purchase suicides, like usually within a few hours of the suicide. But the vast majority are not recent purchase. And so the other aim of the campaign was to give materials to customers, because, you know, once you own guns, you're back for gun cleaning equipment and ammunition and what have you. And to give information to customers about, you know, here are the rules of firearm safety, the guidelines for accident prevention, but we're adding one about being alert to signs of suicide in a family member and where to call for help and the importance of keeping guns from them.
So I mentioned this started in 2009. So that's before, well before Sandy Hook, well before Aurora, well before a lot of the big mass shootings have brought our attention to gun violence in a,
yeah,
and I think a renewed way, even to getting now to talk about this angle of gun violence. And you've seen some results there.
Well, when we checked back in with the gun shop owners, to see who was using the materials, half of the gun shop owners were using the materials, and that's you don't get that kind of uptake that often with public information campaigns. So it was a great group of people to work with, and it can be a difficult issue to find common ground on, when especially like right now when things are very politicized, but this stood out to me as just a really, really hopeful example of people being able to work together.
So let me put this this way. So someone is listening and they say, yeah, they say it's really not about anti-gun owners, but I really hear something different. Because as you know, Congressman from Kentucky, who is a gun owner, has come out and said, we got to have some restrictions. And people said, they're going to take our guns away. And he says, no, they're not. I'm a gun owner, blah, blah, blah. And they said, I don't believe you. So I'm just asking a question for people to say, I don't believe you. You're really bottom line trying to do some gun control here. And if a person is suicidal, if that's your point, they're going to do whatever they have to do. And why focus on the gun? So are there some documented evidence that suggests that if you remove access to the means by which someone would commit suicide, that in fact the suicide goes down, that you can demonstrate that happens, and so therefore you know that happens with guns having limited access as well?
Well, we can go outside the United States to look at some really dramatic examples of how removing a highly lethal, commonly used method can have a dramatic effect on suicide rates. If you go back to England in the 1950s, more than half of all people killed themselves by suicide with carbon monoxide poisoning using coal-burning stoves. Over the next 10 years or so, detoxified gas eliminated the use of these coal-burning stoves, and people no longer had ready access to high levels of toxic carbon monoxide. What happened over those 10 to 15 years is the suicide rate in England dropped dramatically. And it dropped because the rates of suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning dropped. Rates of suicide by other methods did not rise appreciably. The net effect was a huge drop in suicides among men and among women. You can look to Sri Lanka, where toxic pesticides were the primary method used to kill by suicide, when people took their own lives. The toxic pesticides were banned, and in lockstep, you saw a decline in overall suicide rates driven by a decline in suicide rates due to those toxic pesticides without any real change in suicide attempt rates. And then you can come to the United States and look in the 1990s, where gun ownership dropped from, let's say, in the early 1980s of one in two homes having guns to the year 2000, where one in three homes had a gun. And over that time period, what happened was suicide rates went down among 15 to 24-year-olds by about 30%, which is huge. And it was driven largely by a decline in firearm suicides that accompanied the decrease in the proportion of households that had guns. You can look across the United States and ask, why do places that have high guns have higher suicide rates? And as I said earlier, the answer to that is really it's because there are more guns there. The rates of suicide are largely higher because there are higher rates of firearm suicide. Rates of non-firearm suicide are no different, and they have more guns. Case control studies, where you look at people who died in homes with guns and compare them. You look at people who killed themselves and you ask, how likely were they to have a gun in the home? And you compare them to other people who look just like them, same neighborhood, same age, same sex, same mental health background. And what you find out is, yes, in fact, those people who died by suicide compared to people who lived were much more likely to live in homes with guns. So when you consider the totality of the evidence, it's incredibly strong. We don't have a randomized study, you know, where people were given guns and told to go live their life for the next 50 years. And other people said, no, you can't have guns and let's see what happens to you. But we don't have that sort of evidence for linking smoking to lung cancer either. Mm. We didn't randomize smoking. It's the same sort of epistemological approach that has gotten us to say, yes, smoking is causally related to the risk of lung cancer, that has led us to say, you're at risk for suicide if you live in a home with a gun, above and beyond whatever risk you had in the absence of the gun.
That's my guest, Matt Miller. He's Associate Director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. And we're talking about guns and suicide, an angle that a lot of folks have not considered. Let me ask this question, because it occurred to me that when you think about some of the mass shootings, Adam Lanza being the most recent one in Sandy Hook, there were guns in his home. His mother was a gun owner. He clearly had access to it. In the moment, he decided he would go for it. Now, some people look at that. You can look at it two ways and say there is a mass shooting here. That's not a suicide. But he killed himself at the end, as right. did some of these other folks who were perpetrators in mass shootings. Leading me to think, is suicide really... are the mass shootings really kind of almost a cover-up to the suicide that the person was going for in the end? And I wonder if you've thought about that. And, you know, as a result, you have all these victims in the middle when really what the person was trying to do was to kill himself with the gun.
In general, with the mass public shootings, the perpetrator does not intend to get out alive. They're going into it with some exceptions. But in general, they're going into it with the anticipation of killing themselves or being killed.
So, I mean, this we got to talk about this, you know, because as we focus on, as you point out in your research, the individual more than the mass in this case, and there's more individual, you know, people think of suicides individually. Really, you have to think about it in a broader sense. Would you agree, Dr. Miller?
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, the horrific sort of grisly mass slaughter of these little kids just less than 2 months ago is both sort of atypical and typical. It's exemplary and it's extraordinary. It's typical in that it ended in a suicide and that a gun from the home, which as far as we know was legally acquired and possessed, was used in a suicide. That's the kind of gun that's usually used in most suicides.
And to your point, it doesn't appear to have restricted access to all that we know at this point.
No, yeah. Which is why you have to go beyond legislative approaches to really grapple with the exposure to firearms among people who are at mm-hmm. high risk. People have to make good decisions in their own interest. And that means having good information. Mm-hmm. It means freeing up researchers to do good research so they have more information, but also acting on what we already know.
Certainly you could think a lot of lives might have been saved had Adam's family perhaps been a kind of alert to some signs of trouble and taken steps to make sure that he couldn't get his hands on the guns.
Well, we're engaging in a long period now, that I think, of discussion about gun violence and how to deal with it. So hopefully maybe your concerns and your research about firearms and suicide will become a part of this, because so far all we're hearing is sort of mental health, but in a broad way and not very specific to at least this perspective. So I thank you very much for your insight today. We've been talking about new ways to think about firearms and suicide, and I've been speaking with Kathy Barber and Dr. Matt Miller. Kathy Barber directs the Means Matter campaign at the Harvard School of Public Health's Injury Control Research Center, and Dr. Matt Miller is the Associate Director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Emily Rooney back in Studio 3.
Yep, I'm here, and we've got former Secretary of Transportation James Aloisi, and he is the answer man. He says he's got a way to fix the T, budgetary problems and all.
I hope he's got some money, too.
He's going to be digging in our pockets for that, Kelly.
All right, I'm Kelly Crossley.
I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.